It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. Featuring stimulating, in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
To the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect all of us, both locally and globally. And for this, the arts hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel that discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways which we engage with the world. If you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website. It's a question of balance.com. There's podcasts there of all my past shows, all the different interesting topics that we've had and wonderful guests. And you can also connect with me on social media, should you wish, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, etc. So again, the show website is It's a question of balance.com. And on the homepage, there are tabs at the top for guests and topics, which makes it very easy to browse and choose the podcast you want. If you click on one of those, it brings up photographs, a whole page of photographs with the topic question or the guest name, and you can just click on it. It takes you straight through to the podcast page with the audio and information about the guest and photos and links to their website or to the appropriate things to do with the topic. So again, I encourage you to have a look at the website. It's a question of balance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing scientist, philosopher, artist and performer Stephen Friedman. Excelling in academics from an early age, Stephen enrolled in Harvard, majoring in philosophy and graduating cum laude in general studies. He was then accepted into the PhD program in molecular biology at UCLA under a grant from the National Cancer Institute and then into UCLA's School of Medicine. His contributions to molecular biology and medicine range from developing methods to work out the structure of viruses to conceiving smart chemotherapeutics against cancer. Stephen's writings include over 200 works of philosophy, 6 collections of lyric poetry, the play A Passion of the Mind, and the philosophical narrative poem The Books of Joshua. His output has also included such unconventional forms as The Beach Book, Tea Light by the Sea in 5,000 Tea Lights next to Santa Monica Pier in 2009, and The Sky Book, Proving God in Worlds from Even to Odd over Huntington Beach, California in 2010. Stephen's one-man show, Phalaris's Bull, Solving the Riddle of the Great Big World, is a personal and poetic narrative addressing philosophy, art, and science. The show was described by The New Yorker as a truly distinctive piece of theatre and ran at the Beckett Theatre at Theatre Row, New York from December 12, 2015 to January 16, 2016. Sorry, from December 2015 to January 2016. As a fine artist, Stephen Friedman has been represented at Robert Berman Gallery at Bergamo Station Arts Center in Los Angeles since 1999. His art, ranging from representational pastels to acrylic under acrylic poles, has been featured in numerous solo and group exhibitions and has entered major private collections around the world. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you very much, Ruth. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure. I look forward to this.
Yes, me too. As I mentioned, you excelled in academics from a very early age, reading by the age of 2 and going on to study at Harvard and to PhD level in molecular biology at UCLA. In this context of sort of left brain activity, I'm wondering what your earliest memory is of being affected by art of any kind, whether a book, a picture, a song, where you realized the potential power of art to affect us on a deep level rather than just entertain us.
The thing that kind of struck me early on was people's ability to draw, actually. When I was in, I think, the second grade to third grade, there was a student who had this uncanny capacity to represent anything he saw visually. He could draw dinosaurs realistically. And I kind of, that seemed like sort of a compelling power and something that at that point I had no sense of. I mean, my interests, my activities went towards sort of reading, intellectual, sort of abstract thought. That was something that sort of captivated me, you know, philosophy from a young age, mathematics from a young age. The notion of giving something sort of a final finished form that could have the same sort of power as maybe a sentence or an idea was something that kind of first began to interest me at that point. But it would be many years before when I was in high school and in college, I sort of undertook a program of self-education in the arts. When I was around 15 or so, I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey. I had not had much exposure to classical music before. The score, you know, of that film featured, you know, some classical music. My reaction to it was, you know, this is a whole realm of human creativity, human experience that I really have had very little exposure to, no understanding of. There might be something in it, you know, something that, you know, could reward, you know, study and exposure. So around that time, I turned on a classical music station in Los Angeles, where I was living, and I had an edition of Encyclopedia Britannica. I would listen to the classical station every time a composer came on, Mozart, Beethoven, whoever. I'd go to the Britannica, read about him. In the course of 6 months or so, I had sort of, you know, educated myself sufficiently to begin developing a sense of appreciation of standards you know, for classical music. And I would do that virtually from field to field. You know, I would take the approach that, you know, if a large number of people have an interest in this, maybe I won't be able to develop, you know, that kind of passion, but there's that possibility. And there's certainly the possibility that will have something to offer that will be compelling in ways that I can't even begin to anticipate. And that became just my basic approach to education generally, to exposure to whatever it was. It doesn't always reward itself. I'm not, for example, a devotee of jazz, even though I've tried, you know, but still, you know, I as I said, anything that's sort of engaged human creativity, human passion is something that I find at least potentially inherently interesting.
Yes.
And I'll do what I can to come to love it.
When you were talking about the listening to the composers and reading up on them and all the rest of it, it was making me just wonder. Obviously, you are very cerebral. You are very gifted in that area. Did you also feel an emotional response to the music you were listening to, or was it more a sort of intellectual response?
It's always decisively been a matter of emotional response, but. Those emotional responses haven't always been forthcoming. I mean, to some degree, I've had to cultivate them. What I remember, the thing that struck me most of all the sort of exposures to the arts that I had over the years was actually to literature. When I was going through elementary school, junior high school, I was reading a lot on my own, but I wasn't mostly reading fiction. I mostly wasn't reading literature. I was reading science and math and eventually philosophy, you know, those kind of disciplines. But then when I was about 17, I went over to England. My mother was British, and so I had a lot of family there, and I would go there periodically when I was young. And I went there once for a three-month stay. I was staying in the house of an uncle. The first week there, I was reading a magazine, just leafing through like a British magazine, some popular magazine, and I came upon a perfume ad. Now, what I noticed, you know, at that time was British advertisements tended to feature a lot of their classic writers, you know, being quoted. You know, a lot of Shakespeare, a lot of Samuel Johnson. You know, they have like one of what the most illustrious literary traditions of any culture in history. So there's a lot to draw upon. So I opened to a perfume ad, and there was a quotation from Shakespeare's King Lear. Her voice was ever soft, gentle, and low, an excellent thing in woman. And I read that line, and it struck me as the most beautiful line, just in terms of the sound of it, that I had ever read. And I was so captivated, I said to myself, and I hadn't read much Shakespeare. I'd read, you know, the obligatory Shakespeare, maybe Romeo and Juliet when it was assigned, or Julius Caesar when it was assigned, but without any real, you know, deep, you know, passion or connection to it. But when I read that line, I said to myself, anything that contains that line must be worth reading, and must be worth reading, like, in its entirety. So I went the next day to Foyle's, which was a prominent bookstore. I don't think it's there anymore, but at one time I think it might have been like one of the world's largest bookstores. I got a copy of King Lear. I read it. I proceeded to read through all of Shakespeare. And then from that point on, I systematically began reading through English literature, you know, starting with like Chaucer and Spenser and proceeding through Renaissance poets, just the entire literary tradition. But it began from that one line, and it began because that line I found so overwhelmingly beautiful and compelling and evocative.
Yeah, so, and also presumably it's accompanied by a visual image.
Yes, and it's, so in the end, it's emotionality that it's emotionality that drives, I find, intellectual activity. Mozart once said, "The secret to genius," a term that I don't like to invoke, but the secret of genius is simple. It's love, love, love. It's a matter of like an intense, passionate, you know, commitment and response to things. When I write, like, you know, philosophy, I'm writing it, you know, partly obviously for the intellectual content, but also partly in ways that will communicate like the power, the beauty, the majesty, the sublimity, you know, the thought. I want the sound, you know, to convey as much as the actual meaning, you know, that the word's trying to convey.
Yes.
So, yeah, so aesthetics are as important a dimension of creativity to me as any other aspect of the process.
Huh, that's interesting. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest from the arts this week, scientist, philosopher, artist, and performer, Stephen Friedman. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation with Stephen after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Ocean's blast, but steam of late. No white horse fits to play the game. About you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, babe, it just goes nowhere.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Did you know about the Santa Cruz Art League on Broadway in Santa Cruz? Founded in 1919, it's 96 years young and provides a wonderful gallery space for local and national artists. It's a great place to view art with 14 shows a year and also to gain support if you're an artist yourself. There are art classes and weekend workshops, many taught by open studio artists. If you become a member, you receive a newsletter, discounts on classes, gifts and exhibit entries, images of your art on the Art League website, and guaranteed participation in the annual members show. It's also a great place to meet artists. Visit the Santa Cruz Art League at 562 Broadway or the website at scal.org. That's scal.org.
Mm-hmm. Casey, and I'm the second-generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore, and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, philosopher, artist, and performer Stephen Friedman. Marco Rubio notoriously commented that welders make more money than philosophers, saying people deserve to know that the market for Greek philosophers has tightened over the last 2,000 years. Increasingly, it seems everything in life is being valued in terms of money. I'm wondering what you see as the purpose for philosophy today. Obviously, all your work is rooted in that. Yeah. Is it the same purpose as it's always been?
I think philosophy has grown and deepened over the millennia. When people sort of cast aspersions on philosophy, it's just really a kind of a lack of understanding. Philosophy, among other things, created science.
Right.
It created the scientific method. So if we want to look, for the power, of philosophical results, philosophical work, just look to science. I like to talk about, probably the most important 20th century physicists are Einstein and Heisenberg. Mm-hmm. Those are European physicists. America has won more Nobel Prizes in physics than any other country, but we didn't produce Einstein and we didn't produce Heisenberg. We don't produce people at that level because those people were infused by philosophical understanding, philosophical sorts of orientations, modes of philosophical analysis of problems. I was once meeting with a literary agent, Mort Janklow, a famous literary agent, and we had a sort of a long session going over a lot of different results, projects that I had. Mm. And at some point he asked me, what's the source of all of these different results in all these different directions? And I said to him, a core of philosophical analysis. And at that point he stopped me and he said, okay, where you're sitting, some years ago, Steven Weinberg, the Nobel Prize winning physicist, was once sitting. And he said to me that at the highest level, physics becomes philosophy.
Mm.
And so, I understand. I understand. So there was an interview I once saw with Richard Feynman, maybe our greatest physicist, one of the greatest physicists the United States has ever produced, a Nobel Prize winning physicist, as eminent scientist, again, as his country, has to its name. And he was talking about Einstein's work and saying that, he understood the sources, like the source of the ideas for Einstein's early work, his special theory of relativity, as it's called, where E equals mc squared comes from. But he said he didn't understand the fundamental source of ideas for Einstein's general theory of relativity that deals with the nature of gravitation. Well, It turns out that comes from late 19th century German empiricism, that kind of a radical kind of philosophical orientation to the nature of experience. That was something in the air, that Einstein was breathing, when he was like a young person. That's not something that our physicists or that this culture breathes. There's the Harry Potter series began with a book that was published internationally as The Philosopher's Stone, but in this country, it was published as The Sorcerer's Stone.
I know.
Yeah, because publishers were afraid that having philosophy in the title would lose its audience. So it's just a matter of understanding, the power of it, and the fact that philosophy really is only powerful when it's done rigorously and at sort of a high level and at a subtle level. So it's not easy to get good, strong, deep philosophical results.
But if
you can, then you can use them in lots of different directions. I mean, the first thing I did when I wrote my first work in philosophy was to make an application. I had this abstract work that dealt with very general principles of the nature of experience, of the nature of physical systems, the nature of part of what science does, what biology does. And I decided, well, nobody really understands philosophy well, or it's not broadly understood. I need to make an application. What do people care about? Well, they care about cancer. Is it possible to make an application from broad, general, but incontestable, in a sense, philosophical principles to an actual molecular biological application that might be effective against cancer? And it took a lot of reasoning, to bridge that gap from, general philosophy to specific molecular biology. It actually, at the time, took about 3 hours of reasoning, which doesn't necessarily seem like a lot, but if you think to yourself, think continuously for 3 hours, thought, you cover a lot of ground. And it took an enormous amount of ground to cover, but eventually I made an application, and I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what kind of entity it was, but I knew that if it were possible to create it, given the reasoning that went into it, it's likely to be effective at some level. And it turned out to be, I discovered shortly after that, a species of modified virus, a subspecies of virus that satisfied all the conditions for an ideal chemotherapeutic agent. I gave the ideas out at UCLA, other places, the next day, in fact. I thought it would take 10 to 15 years to develop into some actually functional chemotherapeutic agent. It took 12 years. I was coming home one day. I was driving to UCLA, actually, one day. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The 2 o'clock news comes on announcing that a modified cold virus might prove a cancer cure. And it turned out that was the specific result that I had given out and sort of ways to bring that about. And now that's considered one of the leading areas of cancer chemotherapy.
When you were referring to an application, what you mean is that you're taking a philosophical premise and then seeing how there might be a practical application of that in the real world.
And that's as I said, that's what has driven science. It's driven physics at the highest levels. It's not always easy to make that kind of application, but it's something.
What was the philosophical premise that drove that application? Do you remember?
Well,
or is it too complicated?
It was a set of things.
Okay.
Partly it was, I remember one of the ideas, the meaning of the world is its most general representation. So it actually had to do with the premises at the time. The ideas had to do with the nature of generality. And it also had to do with certain inherent weaknesses in controlled experimentation. And so it turns out that to do a controlled experiment, you need two identical objects. Well, you can't get two identical objects. You can't even get two identical points, because those two points, even if they have no properties, are against the background of
a different background.
One is to the left, one is to the right. So there's a fundamental theoretical flaw or limitation in the actual theory of controlled experimentation. So if that's the case, then it should be possible to elaborate alternatives. So instead of focusing on the comparison between two points, I began to focus as a, what I call a heuristic, a device of discovery, a way of maybe getting results on the particular features or properties of an individual point.
Right.
And that,
yeah.
And that led to what I call convergence theory, where we're interested in how many things come together at a given point to create a certain type of object.
Hmm.
And that's the kind of thinking that went into like the cancer work.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. You have an aphoristic approach to your philosophy, and aphorism first appeared as a term in the Aphorisms of Hippocrates. And since then, these succinct truths written in a memorable form have been created by many philosophers and great thinkers through the ages. What do you see as the benefits of this approach?
Lots of benefits. First of all, there's an aesthetic. There's a beauty. You know, in being able to, you know, write something in 5 or 6 or 7 words that has a power to, you know, solve a broad range of problems. The incontrovertible solves the world. That sort of, that the kind of sound of that I find compelling. Partly also, it's something, I don't know, I illustrate it sometimes by reference to a movie. There's a movie called Walk the Line. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It was about Johnny Cash, a biography of Johnny Cash. It was out a few years ago.
Yeah.
There's a scene early on in the movie where Johnny Cash goes to a record executive with his trio and performs a gospel song. And the executive is unimpressed because he said he's heard that song 1,000 times.
You know?
So don't sing for me that song. Sing for me the song that you would sing if you collapsed on the sidewalk and had one final song to deliver. Sing that song. Well, when I write, you know, aphorisms, when I write philosophy, I'm thinking of what can I write that will summarize the totality of experience, resolve the totality of experience, adequate for the final moment of one's life, when one has no time left. So when one has no time left, you know, a book isn't going to do it. A novel isn't going to do it. 5 words might.
Right.
It's almost, you know, there's a line from the Hindu tradition that whatever thought your mind is on at the moment of death, that controls your rebirth. I don't live within, that constellation of ideas, but still that notion of, you want something sort of distilled almost to like a diamond-like, you know, clarity and strength. That's capable of dealing with the worst of circumstances and delivering it in terms of offering the best, possibility.
Yeah. Now, I understand one of your tests for aphorisms is how they hold up in actual life when one is confronted with a challenging situation. And you actually found yourself in this very, very situation, nearly dying. Is that right?
That's absolutely true. It was during the earthquake of 1994, the Northridge earthquake in Los Angeles. I was living in Sherman Oaks, which is a community in the southern end of the San Fernando Valley. So it's about 10 miles or so from Northridge, but against the foothills, on the southern part of the valley. So it turns out that when Caltech did a study of the ground shaking that earthquake produced, obviously Northridge was the most intense, and it came in at like an 8.3. Effective ground shaking on the Richter scale. My area came in at 8.3. So it was intense, and it was intense enough to basically virtually collapse the apartment around me. A wall fell on me. I had hundreds of works of art that all collapsed. I had about 3 feet of debris everywhere, and I was literally in the corner waiting after the wall fell on me, waiting for the ceiling to fall and crush me, which apparently would have happened, I later found out, if a restraining wall had moved another quarter inch.
Goodness.
It was holding up my corner of the building.
Yeah,
so,
gosh.
So at that point where it seemed like, this was the big one, and it seemed like, I wasn't going to survive this, I ran an aphorism through my mind that I had used before, and it actually had always quelled any kind of anxiety that I had. The aphorism was selflessness, how one acts, not out of need. That was something I discovered. It was the first aphorism I discovered that had some power over various kinds of anxieties, fears. I used to have acrophobia, And one day I was experiencing acrophobia. I ran that aphorism through my mind just randomly, just, I don't know, I was kind of playing. And I noticed the acrophobia immediately went away. And I started testing that aphorism in, you know, in different kinds of circumstances. I was experiencing different kinds of, you know, pain, anxiety, whatever it was. And it always quelled, you know, the emotion.
Interesting.
So, that was the first connection between what I was doing, you know, in philosophy, which was meant to be just a rigorous sort of representation of the world, something that, you know, consisted of incontrovertible propositions, and something that might actually help us.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, you know, daily life.
Yeah.
But during the earthquake, when I ran that through my mind, it didn't work.
Mm.
The anxiety stayed the same. So I went to that aphorism I mentioned a moment ago. The meaning of the world is most general representation, which has nothing to do with, or seemingly nothing to do with, like that kind of anxiety or fear. It's something very general. And yet, as soon as I ran that through my mind, I was fine. All the horror of the moment left me. And at that point, I had the sense that, okay, maybe the philosophy needs to be taken increasingly seriously here.
Mm. Well, I want to move on to talking about your work. You have a huge body of work, including writings, plays, art installations, and physical works. And you have a series of books, collections of poetry, the physical narrative poem, the books of Joshua, colour books, and the more unconventional environmental beach books, sky books, and pole books. Before we talk about some of these in more detail, I wanted to ask you about the meaning of the book to you, as you've named all these things books, you know, the kind of the meaning of the written word that sort of flows through these, although some of them are visual representations.
Right. For me, a book is something that has a complete sort of arc of meaning.
Mm.
So it will, I mean, length is not a criterion. I would like to be able to write a book of, you know, like one aphorism, three words. That would be, you know, something of a goal. That would work for me. I will write aphorisms. They're not something that I sit down to write. They will just, after some period of experience of, you know, just kind of going about the world, they'll start coming to me. You know, often they'll come in the middle of the night, and I'll just have to, you know, keep writing them down as they occur. But it will, the aphorisms will start somewhere, and then they'll end. And if they end with a complete sort of resolution of an issue, it's a book.
Right, I see.
And I want it to be something sort of shorter rather than longer, just because it becomes, I think, a better mode of communication.
Yes,
you know, it becomes a mode of communication like advertising. You know, most of, it's been noted a lot, people don't read as much as they used to. It's not even clear, you know, how many professors of philosophy have read through all of Plato or all of Aristotle or all of Kierkegaard. So, my interest is in putting things in a form that they're much more readily assimilatable in.
You know,
you can understand. And what I find is I've written so many aphorisms that usually there'll be one that will sort of bring understanding to a given individual. And once that person understands that aphorism, they basically understand what I'm talking about broadly.
Yes, yeah.
But each one is meant to be a summary of the whole.
Right, yeah. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, philosopher, artist, and performer Stephen Friedman. We'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Danielle and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, philosopher, artist and performer Stephen Friedman. And I wanted to let you know there's a couple of websites you could check out to find out more about Stephen's work. There is solvingtheriddleplay.com, which tells you about his play Phalaris's Bull. So that's solvingtheriddleplay.com. And then there's also another sort of experiential website called thebooksofjoshua.com, thebooksofjoshua.com, which will give you some insight into what he's doing. And also, if you're interested in his artwork, then he is represented by the Robert Berman Gallery in Los Angeles. So, Stephen, we've got about 15 minutes left. So I did want to try and give people a taste of what you do. So I wanted to touch on each of your different sort of things, like the sky books and the beach books. So if we could do maybe like a couple of minutes on each question, if that's possible, that would be great. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Sure.
Great. So firstly, I was going to ask you about the sky books. If you could just tell us briefly how they're presented and how the idea came to you.
Yes. A long time ago, I decided maybe doing some sky writing. I like the concept of sky writing. I like the sky as a canvas. It turns out there's a company called Skytypers that has a patented process of flying five planes in formation with a computer program to generate puffs of smoke that represent like the kind of the dot matrix form of letters that they basically could type in the sky. And with that, you know, instead of being able to do like just like a word, you know, cause with one plane doing skywriting, you don't get very much text in the sky. With five planes flying in formation like that, you can get not a normal book, but one of my aphoristic books.
Right.
So,
yeah.
I decided to do one of those books. It consists of eight aphorisms. The title of the book was proving God in worlds from even to odd. The aphorisms are not just concentrated, but they also rhyme, so it's kind of a poetic expression. Mm. And it took about an hour and a half to put up, and it was made into a 30-minute film. So
wow.
The book is over was done over Huntington Beach,
yeah,
in Southern California.
I think this is such an amazing thing, like a childlike excitement when you see writing in the sky. I don't know, I just have memories of, you know, you would suddenly see something appear in the sky as a sort of sense of wonder. It seems like a...
There's a magic and there's a majesty to it, you know, given, you know, the art of the sky. So, you know, it can create really compelling effects.
Right,
and it's obviously something that becomes a different means of publishing a book than, you know, on, you know, conventional, you know, pieces of paper.
Yeah, so, and similarly, you know, like the beach book is the kind of same idea.
Same idea. I have about 200 of these books that are aphoristic that could be done in different forms, different environmental forms, and the idea is to do them in those forms to share them, you know, with a broader audience. So, yeah, the beach book was basically 5,000 tea lights that were configured next to Santa Monica Pier in the sand, giving, you know, the text of another book, another aphoristic book, Tea Light Book by the Sea, is what it was called. And each one, and it's, they're aphorisms, so each aphorism is kind of a summary, you know, of the whole, and the book itself becomes a summary. So I'm really writing summaries within summaries to try to, you know, help, you know, communicate the ideas. So you don't necessarily have to understand every word or every aphorism. As I said, if you can understand, you know, one of a series of the aphorisms, you're likely, you know, understanding, you know, the whole of what I'm doing.
And having it presented in the outside environment, I think, brings in a whole other dimension of experience, doesn't it? Because you're in the natural world and you're considering these sort of meaning of life type things. It seems a more natural setting almost for that kind of thought.
Absolutely. And it becomes something where you're fusing something that's very abstract and verbal and intellectual with something very concrete. You know, something, you know, like, so you're embodying these sort of abstract thoughts, abstract ideas into very sort of physical, concrete forms.
Yeah.
That, you know, that are, it's like you're trying to do one so that one is worthy of the other. You know, you're trying to make the thought, you know, when you're writing it, worthy of that kind of mode of presentation. And you're trying to make the mode of presentation sort of convey what the thought is aiming for.
Yes, yeah.
So, it's a satisfying, like, aesthetic and intellectual undertaking that you're working, I find, in those forms.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, speaking of the abstract, you have your pole books, which are beautiful acrylic colored poles, which have been described as a visual haiku. How do you create these, and how are they functioning as books to your mind?
Yes. Yeah, the poles they're acrylic rods, clear, you know, transparent acrylic rods that are anywhere from 1 inch to 3 inches in diameter, ranging like as much as 6, 8, and 10 feet in length. Some of them are just, and in general, they're painted on the reverse. The paint I load onto the brush, and each image is achieved with a single brush stroke on the reverse of the pole. So when you're looking at the poles, you're looking through the pole to the image, which is then being magnified by the pole. The pole is also concentrating light. So you get, you know, lots of compelling effects, you know, aesthetic effects.
And these are being inspired by aphorisms as well?
In the basic aesthetic is, in the sense that, you know, the poles are extremely concentrated. And each image, you know, each brushstroke is like an image in the way that each sentence of my aphorisms are like a book. So, you know, they have that, you know, they both share that mode of concentration. But then at some point I decided conspicuously to wed the aphorisms to the poles. And what I did was I would translate some of the aphorisms, a book of aphorisms, into Braille. Braille, you know, gives each letter a pattern of six dots or spaces. And using for the pole books, what I would do is I would use, I'd construct some images out of just two colors, like black and white, let's say, that would represent the dots of the Braille alphabet. And then I would do other images in multicolored, you know, forms. Those would represent for me the spaces. And so using, you know, black and white, let's say, for a dot and a colored image for a space, I would be able to sort of transliterate, you know, a book of aphorisms from the English into Braille into a visual pattern in the poles. And a given, you know, a given aphorism might, it might take, you know, 2 to 4 poles, you know, to paint. A book might be, you know, 28 poles, you know, 30 poles, 36 poles, something of that order.
Wow.
And obviously you would have to know what you were, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be able to read, you know, the aphorisms, you know, as Braille. I mean, those people don't read Braille. And the people that do typically aren't, you know, they're feeling the Braille. They're not seeing it. But it's just it becomes just a schema, you know, for infusing the poles with not just, you know, a visual dimension, but this, you know, literary and intellectual dimension of the aphorisms, you know, that are contained within them.
Yes, yeah, amazing. I mean, they are very beautiful, and to have all that within them is wonderful. Your one-man show, Phalaris's Bull, Solving the Riddle of the Great Big World, recently finished its run, as I mentioned, at the Beckett Theatre at Theatre Row in New York. It was very well received by critics and audiences. It's described as a personal and poetic narrative addressing philosophy, art, and science. I'm wondering, what motivated you to create a play encompassing the different areas of your work?
Basically, an attempt to get things to a broader audience in a different form than conventional, like philosophical communication. And actually, the specific idea came through a producer that I know, a film producer, Al Corley. A couple of years ago, I decided to start making my philosophical results more broadly available. My gallery dealer was interested in not just my art, but in things that I had to say. So when I told him about that interest, he said, why don't we give a talk here? Do the talk here. You can discuss, you know, your philosophy, and it could be broadcast or whatever. So the gallery became the setting for that. One of the people that attended was this producer friend of mine. The talk went on for a couple of hours. It was unscripted, except for some of the poetry that I recited. At the end of it, he was enthusiastic. He said, you know, we could actually maybe work this into something. I was planning another talk a couple weeks later, so I decided to take that, you know, 2-hour presentation and actually generate a 1-hour sort of script, a 1-hour lecture script. I met with this producer a few days before that actual talk. I did some of the talk for him in his car, actually. It was late at night. And about 20 minutes in, he had what I described as a light bulb, you know, phenomenon, where I could see his just head illuminate, and he said, we need to do this as a theatrical event, not just a lecture, something where we can combine art and music and science and just all the different dimensions of your activity with your personal story, you know, to kind of humanize it and give it you know, emotional context, and we will do it in New York. And it was like one of these moments of, okay. And sure enough, a year and a half later, we were in New York. He, you know, true to his word, he sort of found, you know, the project and the enterprise sufficiently compelling that it sustained his interest, and he accomplished his goal. So that's how that came about.
And the New Yorker states that Phalaris's Bull is not just a glorified TED Talk, but the most beautifully mounted philosophy lecture you're ever likely to attend. I'm wondering, what are the challenges and advantages of presenting philosophy as art?
That it's, for one thing, it allows it to communicate not just intellectually, but emotionally. I think I said earlier that you know, even if you're involved in intellectual activity, you're motivated by, you know, intellectual curiosity, but you're fundamentally driven by emotion. You know, like, you're driven by the emotion of the problems that you're confronting. You're driven by the excitement of the process. You're driven by the sense of exhilaration, sublimity, you know, let's say, of the result. And those dimensions, all of those emotional dimensions to the like to the enterprise, to the philosophical enterprise, can best be communicated through some artistic setting. They're not just, you know, like abstract ideas. They're abstract ideas that have meaning and power, you know, for human life on a moment-to-moment basis.
Mm.
And art is designed. You know, one thing I actually, there's an aphorism I wrote some time ago. It goes, art seduces, philosophy coerces. In the sense that when you're doing art, you're using all different sorts of means to try to win people over. You know, and you may be successful, you may not be successful. Some of it depends upon, you know, your capacity as an artist. But you're trying to win somebody over. And whereas when you're doing philosophy, you're working with what you hope is an incontrovertible logic that's incontestable. So you're forced to accept a philosophical conclusion if it's like rigorously, you know, generated. But the two enterprises, art and philosophy, you know, have different aspects to them. But the ability of art to seduce means that philosophy can also be, you know, part of the process of what one can use the art to win people over to the beauty or the emotionality, the emotional force, the possibilities, you know, for the intellectual expression.
So yes.
I find they work hand in hand.
Yeah. We got about a minute left. So I just wanted to ask you, what motivates you to keep creating new works? What keeps your creative passion alive?
Basically, the problems. You know, the problems of human life, human experience. I mean, the original motivation I found in reading Buddhism. You know, Siddhartha's motivation to put an end to disease, old age, and death. You know, he was so, you know, profoundly, you know, moved by, you know, that circumstance of human life, that that's what people were facing. That's the problem that needs to be solved before we can, you know, worry about anything else. So it's. And what I do philosophically and in all kinds of, you know, I guess creative activities is I'll do a work, I'll let's say solve a problem or try to solve a problem, and then once I have a finished work, once I have a philosophical solution, I'll leave the solution and return to, you know, the root of problems. So I'm constantly trying to work outside of any final product, you know, in order to be able to generate new solutions, new approaches, new responses. There's a mathematician, Gauss, a famous 18th century mathematician, who said that, you know, he'll work on a mathematical problem. He will then come, you know, to understanding, come to see the light of it, you know, the light of a solution. And then as soon as he has that solution, he'll go back to the darkness.
Right.
You know, to try to find a new solution, another problem to deal with.
Wow, that's amazing.
You know.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your work with us, Stephen. It's been fascinating hearing about the way you approach everything and your art and philosophy and putting it together. I think it's very important, especially in these times we're in. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Ruth. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. And remember, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. If you enjoyed this interview, then it will be podcasted there. You can tell your friends about it. And thank you for joining me. I look forward to you joining me again next time.